Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What motivated Clarence Darrow to defend some of the most reviled clients of their day, and how did his skills in the courtroom prove so successful in what seemed like hopeless cases? Best remembered today as a defender in the 1925 Scopes Monkey Trial, in his own time, Darrow was associated with no fewer than four cases labeled Trial of the Century. He was a passionate champion of the poor and socially outcast. As many as one in three of his clients had no way to pay him. And his lifelong opposition to the death penalty led him to accept the cases of some defendants simply to spare them from the electric chair. But Darrow was hardly a one-dimensional hero. He was brilliant in the courtroom, but went on trial twice for allegedly bribing a juror. He was a supporter of women's rights and a notorious womanizer. And while he did take some cases pro bono for the sake of justice, he took others strictly for the money they could rake in. My guest, John A. Farrell, has been fascinated with Darrow since childhood. Over the course of his career, he has reported for the Boston Globe and the Denver Post. These days, he is a senior writer for the Center for Public Integrity and author of the new book, Clarence Darrow, Attorney for the Damned. John, welcome to Think.
Hey, glad to be here.
You call Clarence Darrow Jefferson's heir. Can you talk about that?
Sure. The founding fathers envisioned a United States of America based on sort of small-d democracy, where landowners, farmers would gather together at the state capitol, maybe during the harvest, and each man would have his say. There'd be town meetings. And they couldn't have envisioned what happened in the Industrial Revolution. When Darrow was born in 1857, he liked to say, the hired hand could go to the boss's house for dinner. He could sit in his pew on Sunday at church, and he could even date and marry the boss's daughter. And by the time Darrow turned 30, America had been transformed into this industrial giant, and the robber barons had accumulated a great degree of wealth at the top of the pyramid. And it was beyond anybody's conception that the hired man would ever date the boss's daughter. So things changed, and Darrow identified these big industrial forces and later on the forces of the state as threats to individual liberty. And so he was a true Jeffersonian in that regard, and I think he was the foremost champion of liberty of his time.
He did have a rather unorthodox upbringing for a kid born before the Civil War.
Yes, he was born in Northeast Ohio along the path of the Underground Railway to a family of abolitionists and what was then known as free thinkers, folks who didn't believe in organized religion. His father had actually studied for the ministry and then fallen away from his faith. And so Darrow was always brought up with the idea that he should challenge authority.
Now, I love your subtitle, which was a nickname given to Clarence Darrow, Attorney for the Damned, because it sounds almost like the description one might give a patron saint, but you make it clear here that Darrow was not always a paragon of virtue.
No, he's a very, very complex human character. There's an old joke that I like to use, which is that Darrow spent most of his money on wine, women, and song and wasted the rest of it. But he was always looking for money. He had two families to support and mistresses and girlfriends that he liked to chase. He would frustrate his liberal allies as well. There would be times when he would identify, during the Wilson administration, he identified the League of Nations and the World Court as threats to liberty, and during the Roosevelt administration, he identified the New Deal as a threat to liberty. So he was more of a libertarian than he was a classic liberal. Of course, he had ran into trouble with the law himself, being charged twice with bribing jurors.
He did hire women attorneys in his offices, which was unusual for his day, and he supported women's right to vote, but he was very annoyed when women suffragists started to hang out with the temperance people.
Yes, in the 19th century, the women's suffrage movement was an independent, liberal is an overused and bad word, but a progressive idea. Around the turn of the century and afterwards, it became much more of a middle-class movement. And a lot of those middle-class women also identified demon rum as something that was destroying society, hurting folks, working people, breaking up families, causing crime and spousal abuse. And so for a time, prohibition and women's suffrage formed this alliance, and Darrow was both because the liquor industry was his client, but also out of immense personal conviction, was very opposed to prohibition. He saw that as an example of the state reaching in and telling people how to live their lives, and he couldn't abide by it. And of course, the other great example of the state reaching in and messing with people's lives was sexual freedom, and then, of course, the death penalty.
He famously traded this comfortable corporate gig defending a railroad against lawsuits for what became a very passionate commitment to labor rights, including those who had grievances against the railroads. How did he develop that attachment to the working class?
I think he looked around and saw what was happening in the 1880s and the 1890s with the division of wealth in America, immigrants coming in, being forced to work in factories, mines, sweatshops for very little wages, while a very few robber barons got rich at the top. And he instinctively was a man of great compassion. Over and over again, when you read people talking about him, they just talk about this great innate sense of empathy that he had for people who were down on their luck. One of the most famous descriptions of him was given by Nathan Leopold, who was one of his defendants in a grisly case in the 1920s. And Leopold and Loeb were as cold and heartless as individuals, as you can imagine. They kidnapped a 12-year-old boy from the neighborhood and killed him to try to commit the perfect crime just for the thrill of it, as they said. And yet, Darrow found room in his heart even for them, and they were amazed that there was any source of compassion or empathy in Chicago in 1924 that would include them. And they talk about it marvelously. He even touched the cold souls of psychopaths. That's how compassionate a man he was.
Another fascinating case is the Sweet case, because this was an African-American family that was essentially on trial for having defended their own property and lives.
Yes, if you remember, there's a famous photograph of the Ku Klux Klan marching down Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C., with the Capitol Dome behind them. And there's thousands of them marching in their hoods and robes down Pennsylvania Avenue. And that was 1925. And what happened was is that Darrow came out of the Scopes Monkey trial that summer, and he was the most famous lawyer in the world. And he was 68, and as I said, he had trouble hanging on to money all his life. So he was looking forward to a retirement and needed money for that. And he could have commanded titanic fees on Wall Street or with commodities brokers in Chicago, or from rich divorcees, giant corporations. Instead, he decides to go to Detroit, Michigan, where this African-American family had moved into the fringes of a white neighborhood during the great migration of black people from the South to the North that occurred after and around World War I. And their house had been surrounded that night by a white mob. Stones were thrown, windows were broken, and in fright, they fired out the windows, and one of the members of the mob was killed. And so they were all arrested, and they were charged with murder and placed on trial. Now, the NAACP was pushing for a test case to bring before the Supreme Court. They really didn't have an expectation that they could win in Detroit, but they did want a good defense for these folks, and they hired Clarence Darrow, who had been a founding attorney of the organization, and agreed to do the work for a year for $5,000, when he turning down, you know, probably $1 million in fees that he could have made otherwise. The first trial ended in a hang jury, and the second one ended in a not guilty verdict. And even the NAACP was struck. The executive secretary, which was like the executive director of the NAACP at the time, was in the courtroom, and tears ran down his face. He was speechless at the idea that they had actually won, and of course, greatly moved by Darrow's rhetoric. He had challenged the all-white jury to put themselves in a black person's place, and with that trial he established the principle that, yes, even a black man in America has a right to self-defense.
Let's talk for a minute. We'll get to more of his famous and important cases in a bit, but what made him such a brilliant performer in the courtroom?
Well, he had a lot of ham in him, and he was had a big ego, so he didn't at all mind being the center of attention. And that probably was part of the reason that he left corporate law. He was a very successful politician when he moved to Chicago as a young man, and he was successful as a railroad lawyer, which is, I guess, the equivalent of being a Wall Street or a hedge fund lawyer today. He was making a good salary. He had bought a house for his family in Chicago. But he was plagued by a sense that he was not on the right side. He was not defending the underdog. And I think also he just was not cut out for corporate law. He wanted to be in the center of the spotlight. He wanted more attention. And so the first big case that he took after leaving the railroad was the assassin who had killed down Chicago's mayor. And so the first person that Darrow defended famously was the guy who had murdered his boss, because Darrow had been working for the city. He took that case all the way through the courts, tried very hard to save the man. He was obviously a raving lunatic, but Chicago was intent on revenge or vengeance, and the man was hanged. And that was the only man, the only client that Clarence Darrow had that he couldn't save from the death penalty, his first one.
What was his objection to the death penalty?
I think that, there's two things. One was a sort of a personal fear or abhorrence of death. His father was a cabinet maker, and in a small town, that also meant that he made the coffins. And if you made the coffins, sort of by default, you also became the undertaker. So
yeah.
There wasn't a lot of embalming in those days, but the family had a hearse in the barn, and the chickens would roost on it, and then it'd have to be cleaned off when somebody in town died, and one of the coffins that rested in the corner of the cabinet shop would have to be taken out, and the body would lay out in somebody's parlor and then be put in the hearse and carried up the horse-drawn hearse up the hill to the cemetery. And Darrow, as a young boy, was very frightened by this and had an aversion to death. And then his mother died when he was 15, and that was a searing event on him as well. So he had this personal fear and aversion to death, and when it came to losing a client to death, he was almost terrified, and it helped motivate him to put on these great defenses. And the other reason was sort of a political. He was a libertarian, and in the death penalty, he saw the state reaching into individual lives in its most dramatic and heavy-handed way. And again, remember, his parents had brought him up to be a suspect of authority. Hmm. He knew the mistakes that police and prosecutors made. And so that all sort of came together to really form this great archetype of the American defense attorney, the great trial lawyer, standing in front of the jury pleading for the life of the little guy, the common man.
His mother's death is interesting because when he would talk about it later in life, he would refer to himself as having been a little kid when it happened, but he was 15.
Yeah, one of the truly frightening things, of course, you remember he's being brought up in a family of freethinkers where everybody else in town believes that there's a heaven, except that his parents don't. And before she died, his mother called the kids together and said, don't feel too bad. I'm going to a place where we're all going to be. It's all a dream, and your turn will come. And, sure enough, at different points in life, this phrase pops up in Darrow's letters. So this must have been a very influential event on in young Clarence's life, and contributed to this passion that he had. At the time, he was probably the most famous atheist in America. He was known as the most famous atheist in America, although he probably was more accurately described as an agnostic. It sort of all came together and flowed from this great aversion to death that he had.
John A. Farrell is my guest. He's a senior writer for the Center for Public Integrity and author of the new book, Clarence Darrow, Attorney for the Damned. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is John A. Farrell. He's senior writer for the Center for Public Integrity and author of the new book, Clarence Darrow, Attorney for the Damned. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. So, John, arguably the case that really made Clarence Darrow not simply a regional household name but a factor nationwide was when he defended this client, Big Bill Haywood, in 1907. First of all, can you tell us essentially the facts of that case?
Sure. The first prospectors that went out to the Rocky Mountains out west were independent types who, you know, would put their pans and shovels on the back of a mule and walk up into the wilderness and go to the Clearwater streams and look for nuggets of gold. But as this, again, as with almost everything in America, the great industrialization of the end of the 19th century turned those into industrial mines, smelting factories, mining towns, railroad camps. And more and more, these rugged individualists were reduced to the status of what they called wage slaves.
Mm-hmm.
They had to go to work for somebody like the Rockefellers or the Guggenheims, who had huge silver mines or lead mines out in the West. They were paid very little, and they resented it. So they banded together in unions, and, of course, the West being the Wild West, the union versus company violence that accompanied most of the union movement around the country took a very violent turn out there with assassinations and rifle battles and bombings. And in right around the turn of the century, the Western Federation of Miners squared off against the mining companies in Idaho and Colorado and Nevada. And in both Idaho and Colorado, they were basically crushed by industry. And it was said, it was charged that the Western Federation of Miners put together a kill team of assassins who went around and went after mine owners or political officials that they didn't like who had supported the mine owners. And in one case, a former Idaho governor named Frank Stoenenberg came home one night, opened his garden gate, and was killed when a dynamite bomb exploded, triggered by the opening of the gate. Almost immediately, a miner named Harry Orchard was arrested, and he told this tale of being a one-man death machine going around the West killing people for the evil leaders of the Western Federation of Miners. And so the Idaho authorities, who were under the control of the mining company, had arranged to have the three leaders of the Western Federation kidnapped off the streets of Denver, put on a special train, hauled across the West to Idaho, where they were put on trial for their life. And Darrow was hired to defend them. And I would say that in no trial, of all Darrow's trials, no trial better illustrates sort of what law was like in those days, what trials were like in those days, because both sides broke dozens of rules and ethics and of laws of proper courtroom behavior that we're familiar of today. They did almost anything to get a conviction or an exoneration. And in the end, Darrow prevailed, and none of the mining leaders, there were four big trials, and in all of them, there were two non-guilty verdicts and two hung juries. So nobody ended up going to jail, and that really made him one of the most famous labor lawyers in the country and one of the most famous lawyers in the country.
And his closing argument in that case was extraordinary for a number of reasons.
Yes, the eloquence is amazing. The politics of it is amazing. He chose to make an appeal for labor rather than an appeal for Big Bill Haywood's life. Haywood was the secretary treasurer of the union, and he was the first one to go on trial. And a lot of the newspaper men who were there and some of Darrow's co-counsels criticized him for this because they said, well, you know, you're just appealing to the socialists out there and the labor audience out there, and you're not really trying to win Haywood's freedom or to save his life. But Darrow had, it was a very small courtroom, and in fact, the jury, rather than being off on the side like on television, was in chairs in front of the judge. sort of in a tier. And so and right in front of them was the defense and the prosecution table, and they were in that courtroom all summer. So Darrow had the ability to really get to know the individual juries and to read them very well. And so he sort of placed a bet that if he made this appeal, this stirring appeal for labor and against the corporate chieftains off the spiders of Wall Street, as he said, that he would get through to these 12 men, and he did. It was a shocking verdict. Everybody assumed that the best he could hope for was a hung jury. Most people bet that there would have been a conviction, and instead Big Bill Haywood went free.
What was he watching for, Clarence Darrow, when he would sort of monitor the jury?
Well, Darrow's approach in the courtroom was very matter-of-fact, low-key. He sort of was started out like a country lawyer.
Like stick his thumbs in his vest pockets and things like that.
Yes, he had suspenders that he liked to snap.
Yeah.
He was not highfalutin with a lot of oratory. He was talking to, the folks next door, like he'd be talking across a garden gate.
Yeah.
And he would start out, he'd go up to the rail and he'd just start talking to them in a very low voice so that the ones in the back row would lean forward so that they could hear him. And then all of a sudden he'd start shouting and pointing up at the heavens and swinging his fist down into his palm and pointing over at the prosecutors, and then the storm would pass, and he'd tell a joke, and people would relax again, and he had them in the palm of his hand. So he was quite an able practitioner of courtroom psychology.
So another labor case that got huge attention, and as you mentioned, Darrow never shied away in most cases from any kind of media attention, but was the trial of the McNamara brothers, and even he had his doubts going into this one.
Yeah, but before we get to the McNamara's, you have to remember that in those days there was no TV, and of course there was no radio, and there were newspapers, but a big trial in town, was entertainment. And people would jam the aisles of the courtroom. They would surround the courthouse. They'd have ladders so they could climb up and listen in the windows. And so, a Darrow coming to town for a big trial was a big deal. In the McNamara case, again, it was sort of this same type of union versus corporation industrial warfare. And there was this national string of bombings at job sites. And nobody had been injured. The bombs went off at night, and basically they would destroy a bridge span that was in the midst of being built when there was no workmen around. But then finally, in October 1910, in Los Angeles, the Los Angeles Times building, which was a notoriously anti-union newspaper, was blown up and burnt down in the middle of the night, and 20 people were killed. And after a period of investigation, one of the union men became an informer and told the authorities that this had been done by representatives of the Iron Workers Union, and two brothers, James and John McNamara, were arrested and taken to California and put on trial. Darrow went, he was no fool, and he suspected that they were guilty, but he really didn't know until he got out there, and then when he got out there, he found out that, yes, not only were they guilty, but also that the state had accumulated this huge amount of proof against them. And so he did two things. The first one is inarguably he began to negotiate a plea deal. And then the second one is a great argument of history that I came down on the side, on one side in my book, which is that that he went ahead with this, cooperated at least with a scheme to bribe the jurors. And one of the jurors was approached one of Darrow's investigators, and the bribe was passed on a downtown Los Angeles street in broad daylight, and Clarence Darrow stood on the sidewalk across the street watching it happen. So there's been a great debate in history over whether or not he just was there for another reason. Maybe he had been warned and he was there trying to break this up, or maybe it was just coincidental because it was the downtown L.A. street. But he was put on trial.
And we should say, as this is happening, and it's not Darrow with the money in hand, but he's watching it. And
the guy who did it,
yeah, and the investigator was caught red-handed.
Caught red-handed, right? Yeah. And then of course turned state's evidence and said Darrow made me do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so Darrow was in turn charged. But before we get to that trial, we got to take the McNamara's to the end of their case.
All right.
And so he had the McNamara's plead guilty, and this was of course a huge shock to American labor, who had made them into martyrs. It was humiliating for Samuel Gompers, who was the head of the American Federation of Labor, And so when Darrow went on trial himself, organized labor refused to help him, and he was left to his own devices.
So when he went on trial himself, he had two trials for the same crime, is that right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, the first one was one juror, and then there was a second count of bribing a second juror. So, yeah.
So the first one, he was acquitted.
Yes.
And in the second case, essentially it was a hung jury.
Yes, it was 8-4. Eight of the jurors believed that he had done it, and four of them stuck it out and said that he had not.
So he gets off, but he's humiliated.
His career was at an end. I mean, as far as a union lawyer, his career in politics was at an end. He sort of carried back to Chicago this taint. When he first went back, he took cases that were hopeless, and he had to sort of barnstorm the Midwest, giving lectures for $100 and a share of the gate. So his practice was in ruins. And it's one of the great comebacks of American history. The old saying that there's no second acts, well, he certainly put together quite a second act.
Just as a small tangent here, he seems to have practiced in multiple states all over the country. Were the laws different then, requiring attorneys to be licensed to practice in a particular state?
In most states then and now, if you went into a different state, if the state would, the prosecutor would sign off and the judge would sign off, and you'd be allowed to practice.
Mm-hmm. So he was even close to suicide for a while.
He was. There's this famous moment that's recorded by one of his mistresses in Los Angeles, where he showed up at her door one rainy night and walked in. They sat down at a bare wooden table with, she describes it, a single light bulb hanging above them, and out of his overcoat, from one pocket, he takes a bottle of whiskey, and out of the other pocket, he takes a revolver. Hmm. And he says, "Mary, I'm devastated. They're going to charge me with bribing a jury. I can't stand the disgrace. I'm going to kill myself." And so we're very fortunate that she was able to talk him out of it.
So this was his mistress. You have a really remarkable photograph in the book of a celebration for him, and his wife is sitting next to him, and his mistress, is standing between the two of them. What did everybody know about everybody else?
Well, you have to remember that this is Victorian America, and there was a legitimate philosophical, what's called free love movement, which basically said that, you know, despite the Victorian strictures of the marriage laws, if a man and a woman meet each other and are attracted to each other, they should be able to come together. And when that attraction ends, or if they find out they're not suited for each other, they should be able to leave each other. And so there was his roaming around was part philosophical, I guess, and mostly probably just tomcatting. But there was definitely, in addition to all this, a philosophical sort of a political element to this. And there's a great story. One of the cases that he lost was a famous gynecologist from Chicago who had been practicing for 20 years, wrote a paper suggesting that a young woman on her married night should not feel so scared and awful. She should be treated gently by her husband, and she should recognize that over time the two of them would both be able to get pleasure from the act of love. And so this gynecologist wanted to publish this in the American Medical Association journal, and the American Medical Association refused to do so because they were going to have no part in telling the women of America that they should be taking any pleasure from the act of love. So it was different times. We have to sort of give Darrow a little leeway for that.
And in 1915, he defended Frank Lloyd Wright, the architect, for a violation of something that people may not remember this, called the Mann Act.
Yes, it came to be sort of known later in the century as something that prosecutors used to keep you from taking underage girls across state lines. But when it was first passed, it said no single man or woman could cross state lines together. Just the act of cohabitation in a different state was a federal offense. And again, another example of the awful strictures that Victorian America had about sex and love.
So after Darrow's career with the unions had been sort of shattered, he turned his focus in very often to criminal cases, and we've mentioned a couple of those. And essentially, he would argue in many cases that his clients simply didn't deserve the death penalty. I want to go back to Leopold and Loeb, because this is such an interesting, really sickening case in so many ways. But it is, given the circumstances of the case, all but miraculous that he was able to spare them from being executed.
Yeah, and I think that that's one reason why we still know this case. Part of the reason was it came after World War I, which was a much more shocking event to the people of the time than we sort of appreciate now, because we, of course, saw even worse savagery in World War II. But when World War I happened, this kind of mass slaughter and this upending of all morality was quite shocking to people. And the Roaring Twenties was in some ways a reaction to it. There was a great splurge of freedom. Women cut their hair and raised their skirts, and there was also a great fundamentalist reaction to it as well. And Leopold and Loeb came out of it as rich, spoiled young men from Chicago, supremely cynical, not believing. Everything going for them. Mm-hmm. And then when they pulled this stunt of kidnapping and killing a kid from the neighborhood, America, the question wasn't, you know, what happened or who did it. It was, you know, why was it done? Mm-hmm. And I think to this day, that's the great fascination of looking back and just sort of seeing this impromptu, cold evil coming out of the souls of men. We're more used to it now, but at the time it was quite shocking, and I think that's why, you know, it's been immortalized by Hollywood in Alfred Hitchcock's Rope and Orson Welles in Compulsion. You can still find it showing up in novels and plays being written today.
How did he choose which cases to take and which to turn down, if money wasn't always an object?
I think he chose, well, two reasons. One is if anybody came to him with a hard luck story, he had a hard time turning them down.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that impressed me as I went through all the famous cases was that number of cases where demented individuals would do some awful, you know, crime, like, you know, slashing the throat of delivery boy would bring the groceries to some lady's house and slash her throat and kill her toddler, and then, you know, get back on his bicycle and keep doing his rounds. And, you know, the instinctive reaction of Chicago was to just execute this person. And Darryl was, you know, nobody cared about this crazed individual. And Darryl was the one who stepped forward and, for no money, would go to the authorities and say, look, we're civilized. We know that this individual is crazy. He's not responsible for his actions, no matter how horrible they are. We need to find a way to put him away where he'll get some treatment, but also, you know, society will be safer.
John A. Farrell is my guest. His new book is called Clarence Darrow, Attorney for the Damned. We'll resume the conversation in a moment. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author John Farrell. He's a senior writer for the Center for Public Integrity and author of the new book, Clarence Darrow, Attorney for the Damned. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. John, I think my favorite account to read in this book was of the Scopes monkey trial, which, technically speaking, Darrow and his client lost. But in terms of sort of the impression left, it would seem in many ways that they won this case. Remind us again of the facts here. It wasn't like John Scopes went into this not knowing what was going to happen.
No, of course, the movie that immortalizes the monkey trial is Inherit the Wind, with that tremendous riveting performance by Spencer Tracy.
Yeah.
But the monkey trial was pretty much a staged event from the beginning. William Jennings Bryan, who was a Democratic presidential candidate and former Secretary of State, had joined with that fundamentalist movement I was talking about after World War I, and gone around the country trying to get legislatures to prohibit the teaching of Darwinism in biology classes, because they thought that Darwin's theory, which was survival of the fittest, was part of what had led to Prussian militarism in World War I. And they wanted to stick to the verities of Genesis in the Bible. The American Civil Liberties Union in New York decided that, as these legislatures started passing these laws, that they needed a test case. And when Tennessee passed the law, they advertised in Tennessee newspapers asking if there was anybody being prosecuted down there who would be willing to participate. And citizens of Little Dayton, Tennessee, sitting around a table in the drugstore sipping Coca-Colas, decided that the summer was a pretty sleepy time, and the local economy had been in the dumps since the forge closed down, and why don't we put on the show?
Hmm.
And they did, and they had no idea, of course, what they were getting into, but Brian agreed to come to prosecute the school teacher, John Scopes, and as soon as Brian signed up, then that brought Darrow in, and before you knew it, the monkey trial was this amazing circus. From the beginning, everybody knew that Scopes was going to be convicted. The whole idea was to get the case to the Supreme Court,
right.
And there's a telegram from the founding fathers of Dayton to the ACLU saying, you know, yes, the biology teacher agrees to be convicted and you'll have your case. So everybody knew from the start that it was going to be a circus. But lawyers being what they are, which is constitutionally argumentative and not really wanting to lose, it turned into much more of that, and it culminated in a great confrontation between Darrow and William Jennings Bryan, which came around because the judge refused to let Darrow call scientific experts to the stand, and Darrow said, okay, well, if I can't call a scientific expert, I'm going to call a biblical expert, and he called William Jennings Bryan, who was, to his misfortune, foolish enough to agree to this test of wills.
So, yeah, talk about the line. First of all, we should say that there were so many people there that they held a lot of these proceedings outdoors on, I guess, in the courthouse square?
It's a wonderful place. You can still visit it today. It's been preserved. The courthouse square is there. The courtroom is still in use. It's still being used as a courtroom today. Downstairs in the basement is a nice little museum, including the famous table from the drugstore. And every July, when they commemorate the trial, they build again this wooden platform on one side of the courthouse where this confrontation took place between Darrow and William Jennings Bryan, and people all gathered around under the shade of the trees because there was just too many to fit into the courtroom itself, and the judge was afraid that the floor would collapse.
So Darrow calls William Jennings Bryan to the witness stand, Bryan, who is the prosecuting attorney on the other side of the case, and asks him essentially to testify about things in the Bible. Is that right?
Right. And Brian slipped up in two ways. The first way was that in addition to asking questions about the Bible, Darrow also asked questions about basic science, basic geology. And Brian showed just an ignorance and a willful ignorance. He didn't even want to hear about it. So to the larger audience outside of Dayton, and this was the first trial to be broadcast nationally, it was very clear that Brian didn't know what he was talking about when it came to science. Then Darrow asked him a bunch of questions, or as well, he asked him a bunch of questions about the Bible. You know, how did Jonah survive for 3 days in the belly of a whale? And how did the snake get around before God forced it to crawl around on its belly? Did it hop around on its tail? And in the course of these questions, some of which elicited laughter from the crowd, Brian got flustered, and he made this concession that, well, you know, Genesis didn't have to happen in 7 24-hour days. Some of those days could have been hundreds of thousands or millions of years long because, you know, the term day, it does not have to be taken literally. And as soon as you say that, as soon as you sort of say that the Bible is open to interpretation, it doesn't have to be taken literally, you've sort of punched a hole in the whole fundamentalist argument. And so even the fundamentalists were disappointed in Brian when he made that concession. And so by the time that he stepped down, the press had pretty much declared Darrow the winner, and indeed even the prosecution refused to let the two of them go at it again the second day like Brian wanted to, because they were just afraid there would be further embarrassment.
Do you think Darrow would be shocked to find that 86 years later we're still having the same arguments?
I don't think so. He did not have a really great opinion of humanity. He had a great love and sympathy for us. He believed that we were like sailors on a raft in the midst of a storm-tossed sea, buffeted by forces well beyond our control, and the only thing we really could do was reach out and try to give each other comfort. So he did have great sympathy for humanity, but he didn't really have a great deal of respect for our ability to act smartly and overcome our superstitions and our passions.
If he were working today, you know, reading through this and the kinds of cases that he would take, often on the principle that people weren't truly guilty unless their intentions were really dark. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, his definition of guilt was, and in some ways it applies to today in courtrooms, it applies all to motive. He went further than the law, and actually said that even if you had a motive and you committed what society called a crime, if you did it out of a good reason, then it really wasn't a crime. It really wasn't. You might have been breaking a technical law written by a legislator somewhere, but it really wasn't anything wrong. And he argued famously before the U.S. Supreme Court that if 100,000 working men, as they had in the Great Railway Strike of 1893, walked off the job, then that was proof in itself that this was not an illegal act, no matter what the law said, because 100,000 Americans acting in union could not be committing a crime together. They were obviously justified in doing what they were doing. Otherwise, you never could have gotten so many people thinking the same way and believing so passionately that they were being wrong. So, of course, this does not go very well with religious folks, and Darrow was not a religious person himself. He didn't believe that in justice. He didn't believe in right and wrong. He basically only believed in mercy.
Would he be at Guantanamo Bay if he lived in 2011 trying to provide at least legal justice for defendants?
Yeah, that's the kind of case that he would take. I think that also he would, I know for sure he would have been a leader in the battle against the death penalty in some of the cases in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And people ask me, you know, where are the Darrows today? And I say, well, it's very hard to find a trial lawyer who, once they get that kind of fame for winning a big case, continue to also defend the little guy. But there are, I think, for example, in Texas, you have a magnificent number of individuals who go out and defend these capital punishment cases, knowing that they're going to lose, knowing that their client is going to be executed, but still believing in what they do. They really are unsung Darrows. They're unsung heroes. They're Darrows that we don't really pay much attention to because, to a large extent, their argument makes us uncomfortable.
Did he have any money at the end of his life?
He had a little bit of money, but he lost it in the Great Depression, the crash of 1929. And it was very sad. He had to go out and do lectures and do little stunts like, you know, appear on the radio as Benedict Arnold's attorney trying to, you know, in a stage trial, trying to defend Benedict Arnold. He appeared in a movie about biology after the monkey trial. And he took one case that was particularly disappointing in Hawaii, in which he basically defended a lynch mob after spending his entire life as a supporter and one of the founders of the NAACP at the very end because he needed the money, and he frankly admitted it. He went to Ohio, to Hawaii, and defended this small group of men and women who had murdered a native Hawaiian in a what was supposedly an honor killing of the husband by the husband of a rape victim. And he didn't get them off. They were found guilty by the jury, but he managed to use the political turmoil about this case to persuade the governor to commute their sentences to 1 hour. And so they spent that 1 hour in the governor's office, and then they were free to go. And he quickly packed them up onto Darrow quickly packed them onto a ship and got them out of Hawaii into the to the mainland before anybody could try them again.
He did write a memoir of his early life. Was he a pretty self-aware individual?
Yeah, he was a marvelously multifaceted person. He was a philosophizer, as I said, and he also was a novelist. He wrote two novels.
Were they any good?
Yeah, one of them, the first one was called Farmington. It's a story of his boyhood in the Midwest, and it's very subtle critique of life in a small town, America. The other one is not quite so good. He wrote some wonderful journalism, dispatches from overseas, and also sort of muckraking articles about how that exposed the weaknesses of the law and the legal system.
What did the people who were closest to him think with regard to his tendency, perhaps on more than one occasion, to tamper with juries?
I think they forgave it. They knew it was, you know, again, you have to put everything into context. And you know, for example, the juries that weighed his case in Southern California, one of them came out and said, look, you know, we've lived here for 20 years. We've watched the Southern Pacific Railroad corrupt juries time after time again. And, you know, this is not something that's rare. There was a famous case in San Francisco that Darrow's lawyer had participated in which case he had kidnapped a newspaper editor to keep him from testifying in court. And he was never prosecuted for it because it was sort of seen as almost as hijinks.
Yeah.
You know, stealing evidence and that kind of thing was part of the industrial warfare that was going on between capital and labor.
So there's this charming story of you sort of being captivated by Darrow from the age of 12, and he was like a childhood hero for you. Was it daunting at all to know that you were going to go into this project with the very critical and thorough eye of a journalist as opposed to a fan?
Yeah, I mean, when you decide you're going to do a biography of somebody, you sort of know that you're going to be living with this person for 5 or 6 years of your life. And other than your family, this is the person that you're going to be thinking about all the time. So you have to pick carefully. And in picking Darrow, I was picking a hero, somebody that I had read Irving Stone's great book, Clarence Darrow for the Defense, when I was 12 years old, had wanted to become a lawyer until graduated from college the same year as Watergate, and all the lawyers were going off to prison with handcuffs on, and instead became a journalist.
So you found some new things that people hadn't explored before?
Yeah, I think I moved the ball forward on whether or not he had indeed bribed the jury. I found a series of catches of letters and documents in different places around the country, and I was immeasurably helped by the fact that about 10 years ago, a letters collector went to Darrow's granddaughter and said, do you mind if we rummage around in the basement and see what we can find? And they found a box there that said Christmas ornaments, and when they opened that up, there were 1,000 letters to and from Darrow that had never been used by scholars before. And they were opened last summer at the University of Minnesota. So I had this great advantage of that. There was another collection at Boston University. I went down to Austin to the Ransom Library, where there was a collection from Darrow's law partner, the poet Edgar Lee Masters, and out to Oregon, where Darrow's mistress's diaries were.
Well, you've got lots of great stuff. I'm sorry that we're out of time. The new book by John A. Farrell is called Clarence Darrow, Attorney for the Damned. John, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.